This is netstack.fm, your weekly podcast about networking, Rust, and everything in between. You are listening to episode 8, recorded on the 2nd of October 2025, where Glenn has a conversation with Bruno Dalvo Silva, staff software engineer at Google, where he works on NetStack 3 and Fuchsia.
Welcome this week in another episode of NetStack.fm. This week we will talk with Bruno. He is working for Google at NetStack 3, which despite the similar name of our podcast has nothing to do with us. However, today we will learn all about it. Welcome, Bruno.
Thank you for having me. Yeah, it's nice to meet you.
Yes. So before we get into technicalities, I would like to get to know you a bit better as I don't know you yet. So could you tell a bit more about your origin story and why you are here where you are now?
Sure. All right. So I'm originally from Brazil. So started in part of Brazil, a place called Porto Alegre. And so let's start with just how I got into computers and programming. Both my parents were in IT, as like not programmers, but in IT generally. So like I had some contact with it until one important day where I found my cousin who had a little software house programming. Like I asked my father, what is he doing? Oh, he's coding. And so I want to do that. And that was the beginning of it. It started with Visual Basic books and then quickly into like a PHP and then Flash courses and books. And then I got into C++ systems programming and went to school. And for some hubris of a 17-year-old, I decided to study electronic engineering at school because I felt like I already knew how to program. Sheer hubris. I tried to undo that mistake with a master's later on in life, but I ended up dropping out. And yeah, so I did a quick stint in northern France as part of schooling, which was, you know, I guess, interesting and studied a lot of different things in France. And that's when I started to look for jobs, I realized that knowing how to code was the thing that was getting me job offers and not all of the engineering studies. So then, you know, went back from France to Brazil, and an acquaintance that I met there, he had come back too, and he was running a firmware team at a small shop. So I started with firmware, just Cortex, M3 embedded, and I was doing port quality measurements, a lot of DSP. I loved doing digital signal processing. It was so much fun. And, you know, switching jobs here and there, I did a stint at HP. I was doing a lot of mobile development, a little bit of web. But then at HP was when I started connectivity-related work with Bluetooth. And that was fun. That was like reading RFCs, coding up the thing. I was doing a little bit of firmware then too, just writing up Bluetooth protocols and whatnot. But not really networking per se, just connectivity, you know? And from there, you know, job offer at Google, I remember during the interview, the guy asked, oh, you know, I actually run a Bluetooth and a networking team. Do you want to keep doing Bluetooth? I'm like, nah, I'm all done. I want to try something new. And I was just really looking to do something different. And that's when I joined Google and Fuchsia, right, as part of the networking stack team. So that's been the past 7 years there. And I had very little exposure to actual networking by then. Except for I could configure a home router. I knew roughly what DHCP was, TCP, UDP, but that's it. And similarly for Rust, by the way, I was doing mostly C, C++, and some like Java mobile app development for most of my career. And Fuchsia was investing heavily into Rust, and so like that's what I did, and I learned, and I absolutely fell in love with it, to be honest. So expressive, and you know, that's how I ended up here. You know, and joined, it's straight into the Fuchsia team, and I've been there for 7 years.
Wow, that's a heck of a story. Thank you very much for sharing that. Now, before we go further with Fuchsia, which I do want to dive into, like, as you mentioned, you had like a background in more traditional engineering. Do you feel like it helped you in any way in the rest of your career?
That is a great question. I ended up in engineering because I really liked studying math at school. So it helped me early on in my DSP ventures, right? Because there's like, it's very math heavy. I had a little detour into AR at my time at HP, and so augmented reality. And so like the math helped there too with computer vision, but not really. I think like just, if I had to say, mostly the logical thinking that comes from the engineering thing and just liking to tinker is what helps me today. A part of me regrets not studying computer science formally. Life taught me what I needed to learn about those things. I love reading about it, and that's the part of me that regrets going into DME.
I understand, but at the same time, I often feel that it might be easier to learn computer science on your own, especially if you have good peers at a company like Google, compared to learning something like digital signal processing and, I don't know, electronic routing and all that stuff, which I imagine that's, might be easier to learn in school.
That is very, very fair. Yeah, I you know, I have a lot of my peers at Google to thank for just like really bringing me up to speed on a lot of things. It's an amazing company, and like I have amazing peers. And like the people who taught me Rust are all still there, and I'm thankful for that too.
Yes, and then you also after that did a lot of work on Bluetooth, as well as before that digital signal processing. I mean, in a way, it is kind of related to networking, as you are still dealing with communication, you are dealing with encoding, decoding, you are dealing with protocols. I suppose that experience did help you a lot getting quite quickly up to speed with the networking team at Fuchsia.
It is definitely relatable. I find that, you know, the underlying theme, I think, for all my career has been systems programming, right? And I see networking as the, you know, the level of networking which I work on is like, it's a big branch of systems programming for sure.
Yes. And the kind of networking you do is the kind of networking I love as well. So let's go for it. Now, most folks might know Fuchsia, or maybe not. I am not really certain. So could you perhaps introduce Fuchsia, as well as how did it get started and how did they come up picking Rust?
Right. So I'm not the best Fuchsia historian because it predates me. But so Fuchsia is a modern operating system that aims to be like simple, secure, updatable, and performant. That's the goal. It's a general purpose operating system. Okay. And it's open source. You can go look at all the documentation that we have at fuchsia.dev. So for a little bit more in-depth vision on the technicals there, Fuchsia is built on a microkernel architecture. The kernel is called Zircon, and pretty much everything runs in user space. That includes, you know, for our conversation, the network stack itself, the network drivers. It's all in user space. And in very early Fuchsia, we needed a network stack. That was before my time. There was an attempt at a network stack with LWIP. It was somewhat short-lived, like it served the purpose at the time, as I understand. And then there was this push to go into what we call NetStack 2 now, that is based on the gVisor stack. Right? So like gVisor is the big project at Google that intercepts the syscall with the layer with containers, right? And we're all, you know, siblings at the company. We reached out and we pulled in the gVisor TCP IP package, they call it. So like basically the IP stack implementation, and put Fuchsia bindings around it. gVisor is written in Go. So that also meant at the time that Fuchsia had a Go fork, so that Fuchsia was an available target for the Go runtime, right? And over time, at the time, other systems in Fuchsia were using Go, right? But over time, we just learned that like at this level, the garbage collector and the runtime costs are just too high, right? gVisor was fantastic for us. It still serves a great purpose. Like the TCP implementation is very mature. We were missing a couple of things, and we actually worked with the gVisor team to add the things that we were missing at the time. It was very fruitful. But ultimately, other systems within Fuchsia have moved away from it, from the Go runtime, and the NetStack was there. Around the time I joined, NetStack 3 was starting to be talked about. Oh, we want it would be great to have a network stack in Rust. We will stop paying the Go runtime costs, and we'll be able to build something that like we can iterate fast on for Fuchsia. And, you know, bugs are like, you know, 7 years later, we're still working on it. You know, most targets on Fuchsia today are using NetStack 3. We haven't managed to move everything off of NetStack 2. It is happening. And part of it, you don't want to maintain two things. You want to be able to focus on one thing. But partly, NetStack 3 is proving fruitful in the things that we wanted it to be good, which is fast iteration, be able to go deep in like Fuchsia necessities for the stack. And the memory footprint is massively lower because you're not paying runtime costs. You have deterministic memory. You know, you're not dealing with the GC. So, like, it's paying off.
Wow. Okay. Thank you. There is so much to unpack there. So I'm going to go at it bit by bit. Now, you mentioned, okay, it comes from Hypervisor, NetStack 2. Like, I didn't know NetStack 2, and I was going to ask you about it. So I'm very glad you mentioned it. I did know about NetStack 1 or just NetStack. Did everybody that was on NetStack just move to NetStack 2, or were these two systems living next to each other?
I don't know. This was before my time. I joined when NetStack 2 was already pretty mature and in place. NetStack 1 was a memory at the time.
Okay, fair enough. Okay, and then as you mentioned a bit about footprint, and I don't want to go too deep into it, but I do find an interesting topic which does not get mentioned enough in the Rust community. Like, do you do anything specifically around allocations? Like, do you use arena allocators, other kind of custom allocators, or is it just purely the Rust allocation, like what it provides you, like allocating effect and whatever?
That's a great question. Not currently. You could look at our code. We're not doing anything that is very fancy there. It's basically just using the allocators that we get from the system. We run in user space, so we just get a heap, right? Most of the win here is just really the Go runtime is big, right? And so it itself carries a lot of it with the scheduler, with the memory module and everything. So a lot of our wins are there, but a lot of our wins are also in terms of like deterministic memory management, right? Because the Go runtime has its own heuristics and you can tune them, but to a point, right? In building NetStack 3, we really wanted to be accountable for all of the memory, right? And so we have like fine control over it. I have really good control over what is the memory allocated for TCP buffers, for device buffers, for neighbor tables, routing tables, all of that. So it's really easy to account for and either optimize if needed or at the very least just get rid of them when I you know, with RAII, I'm just going to drop the thing and the memory should be gone.
Yes, exactly. Very cool. And then you mentioned Fuchsia is a microkernel. Like, I love that kind of system. I think it's the future. Of course, it's difficult to move away from all the monolithic ones. I suppose that means that compared to something like Linux, you have relatively few updates required to the kernel itself, because if you look at the Linux development, they are releasing updates very frequently to the kernel itself because a lot of it is contained within the kernel. But for you guys, I suppose you don't have to touch the core of it, which is the kernel space, too often, or am I wrong?
That's correct. I've been there for a while. I've touched many components in the system. I think I read the kernel source often. I don't think I ever published a change request for it, ever.
Okay.
But yeah, it's part of the core of Fuchsia updatability, right? And I think like having your system more fragmented in that sense with stable API boundaries and ABI boundaries is part of the updatability story.
Okay. And I was under the impression, but I don't know too much about Fuchsia, so do correct me, that it was mostly for embedded systems. Or is that not correct? What is the aim? Mm-hmm. Like, what are you mostly aiming to use for?
It's a general purpose operating system, and it's growing, and we're adding what we need to be a general purpose operating system.
Okay. Would it one day like be used to replace Android, or is it like a whole different kind of story?
I don't know.
Yeah. Okay, that's fair enough. And then way before I knew about Fuchsia, I did know about Redux, which is like another operating system written in Rust, and I have contributed to it a bit in the past, very minor things. Have you looked at that kind of code? You were in the team, and what do you think about that system?
I'm not super familiar with that, right? I am excited that so many people are trying toy OSs these days. It's very fun. It is very easy to underestimate how much work it is. I think you can see sprinkles of that in the community, right? But yeah, and I think there's a lot of work in the embedded space. There's a little bit less work in the general purpose operating system space, but there is some, which is the most exciting part because, you know, sometimes you got to try to reinvent things to discover interesting things along the way. I really like these tiny OS projects around the Rust community and experimenting with stuff and like, how can you make a full kernel, for example, with memory safety? It's very, very exciting.
Yeah,
but
for sure.
I'm a fuchsia native person at heart, and I spend 90% of my time on it, and I've done very little exploring except for reading blog posts and staring at the code here and there for other things.
I understand. I know, like, in companies like Apple, and I think it used to be at Microsoft, and I'm not sure anymore it's the same true anymore, but at least in Apple, I think they used to dog feed on their own system, so they would, like, develop from, like, their own systems on the edge. Do you, in your team, also work from Fuchsia, like, in your, as a dev environment, or, like, what I mean is, like, it is your daily driver to work and use a computer or not?
No, not at all. So my flow is more, the Fuchsia development environment is tuned to work on Linux, right? And I run Fuchsia on an emulator. A lot of the time, we have some hardware targets that we experiment with, both ARM and x64, and you know, that's so I communicate with it. So right now, actually, the big development bridge is networking. So like the network stack is really, really in there because most of the development happens over like some sort of TCP or SSH socket. So, you know, part of what is very cool of writing a new stack there, given we're talking about development, is that to move targets to NetStack 3, we had to be good enough to not interfere with the development of anyone that was working on that target. That set a very high bar as replacement in the beginning. It had to be pretty workable. Even if the target was just experimental, you need this for the developers to work on it and continue developing the target. So that was very cool.
Well, I can imagine you have a lot of like insider war stories there, but let's not go there. Now, when we talked a bit before the podcast about NetStack 3, you mentioned it at like two interesting points. I mean, in general, it is interesting, but you mentioned two interesting things, which is one, implementing the protocols themselves for wire compatibility, and two, implementing a POSIX compatible API. I would like to dive a bit in the second point first. The POSIX compatible API, is it mostly because developers are familiar with it and that's like nicer to work in? Or is there like a technical reason why you need POSIX compatibility there in this new system, which in the end lives on itself?
Yeah, that's a great question. So Fuchsia aims to be POSIX compatible, right? So like you can build a component for Fuchsia and you can like use libc and it's going to look like a POSIX API, right? So how does this work in Fuchsia? The network stack is not in the kernel. It's a component. So if you are going to make a socket call, this becomes an IPC call to the network stack process, right? So libc exists and it translates the POSIX calls to what we call Fiddle. It's the Fuchsia interface definition language. So that's our IPC mechanism to the network stack. So this is the POSIX API is mostly for familiarity. Familiarity is one of the most powerful things you can have when you're introducing a new system, right? If you want to drive adoption. So it really, really helps. And NetStack 3 really aims to be POSIX compatible. And that includes, we tend to think of just the data path, but that includes so many things and so many behaviors. Think of all the socket options, the ancillary metadata that you can get from a UDP socket. You can get most of the IP layer options when you use RecvMessage, for example. There's a lot of complexity there. And there's some fuchsia-flavored complexity about doing this performantly over an IPC call.
Okay. And so let's start diving a bit into the protocols, because of course we could start with TCP, but below TCP there are also a lot of important protocols way before you even get to TCP, including also the drivers to talk to the hardware, which I assume you might need to also write, or maybe you can port them from existing systems. So let's start perhaps with like a bit of an overview, like what's living in that land.
Okay, let's. Do you want to do life of a packet, maybe?
Yeah, that sounds very cool. Let's do this.
Sure. Let's do that, and then we can sprinkle protocols along the way. So life of a packet in Fuchsia looks like you're going to have a driver. That driver is developed for Fuchsia, because the driver API is completely different. You want, like, it's going to be different. So that driver is specified for Fuchsia. There, we have an API for a driver to communicate with the network stack that involves shared memory, so we reduce data copying and all of that. An ingress packet's going to go into that shared memory. The network stack gets notified of however many packets are in the receive queue, and it pops one at a time, right? So that's going to traverse the stack. You're going to typically have then on the parsing side, you're going to parse the packet. It's probably going to be like Ethernet. You're going to check, is this for me? Is this not for me? And then you're going to demux the Ethernet protocols, generally ARP, IPv4, IPv6, right? So ARP is address resolution protocol, which is a thing that you don't hear a lot about if you're not in networking. And those are the three big ones. Then you're going to demux that up web one layer. So we get to the IP layer, and that's where I'm going to plug in Rust in NetStack 3 that, I really enjoyed how we managed to get most of the IP processing in NetStack 3 to use the type system so that I can write the code once and just differentiate behavior based on IP version here and there. Right? Because
the standard library for that, like the STDNet, or is it like something custom?
Well, we have our own crate called NetTypes, right? We provide some conversions between this crate and standard if we need to interoperate, but within, we don't use the so we have our own types, and there's like basically an IP trait, and then we implement for concrete types with IPv4 and IPv6. So like if you browse NetStack 3 code, a lot of the code has an I type parameter on it that is bound on IP, and that's a function that can be called either for IPv4 or IPv6, for example. So let's say I have an IPv4 packet that is going to hit via monomorphization. It's going to hit the IPv4 ingress path. Then you have like the things that look more like general purpose network stack things. We're going to hit filtering hooks, connection tracking hooks. That's for firewalling. You're going to hit your routing table to decide, is this packet for me? Should I forward it later to someone? That's a lot of the IP layer complexity if you're thinking about the OSI layer models. Let's say this was a TCP packet, so you're going to dispatch this up to the TCP layer. Then you're going to hit the TCP demux because TCP has ports. Your source port is going to tell you which socket is going to receive that. You find the socket. Now you're going to parse the TCP, the rest of the TCP segment, and set process the TCP state machine. In the case of TCP for UDP, it's easier. Just stash that in a receive queue. If that's good, and for TCP, there's like you kick the state machine to send X if necessary and whatnot, right? So that's basically the life of an ingress.
And that entire, like from start to finish, what you told now, you were saying that this is all allocated once and it's reusing that same memory throughout the entire stack. Or
that's
did you already have to? Yeah, well,
that's correct. Cool. Yeah, that's all, and that's all done. The shared memory part requires a little bit of unsafe, to be fair, right? Because it's shared memory. So like we have like a safe API for a little bit of unsafe inside, but the rest is basically abstracted behind a buffer trait, and it's backed by either a slice or an own buffer. And it just crosses the stack and it's good, right? And then when you hit, for example, UDP, like the UDP receive queue, if you have a slice, you have to make it own because you're going to return out. That's, you know, another thing where memory goes. And for TCP, you need to put it in a different type of queue that looks more like a ring buffer.
Very cool. And so once we're at that point, I should be able to compile any usual Rust program that has the target as Fuchsia and I can just bind to a TCP socket and I will receive packets, right?
That's correct.
Wow, that's really cool. And so you are correct that I'm familiar with like IPv4, IPv6, but you also mentioned like ARP. Could you maybe give a quick intro for me?
Yeah, of course. ARP is for IPv4. ARP is the address resolution protocol for IPv4, right? So if you're on a LAN, your computer wants to send a TCP segment to your router so it makes it to the internet. Your IP frame is going to have the IP address of the website you're trying to reach. But how does your computer know that the next thing here is the router, right? So that's in your routing table. Your routing table is going to first say, yeah, like this is your default gateway, right? And then it has your router's IP address as your gateway. But at the Ethernet layer, which also happens for Wi-Fi, you need to unicast this packet to your router using the router's Ethernet MAC address. And ARP is the protocol by which you resolve that. So your packet effectively gets queued up until I'm able to resolve the unicast. And then we send an ARP packet that says, let's say your router is 10.0.0.1. You send an ARP packet that says, who has 10.0.0.1? And the router responds, I have 0.0.1, and here is my MAC address. And then you send your IP packet that has been in the queue all this time, gets an Ethernet header with source MAC, my MAC, destination MAC, the one I just learned, and, Ethernet protocol IPv4, and then you send that to the router. That's what ARP is doing. It's called, since the introduction of IPv6, we tend to call this, like, a lot neighbor resolution. That's what it's called in IPv6. So, like, this is, the neighbor table is, like, your neighbors on the LAN and how do you resolve their addresses.
Yes. Okay. Very nice. That was very far in my back, so I'm very glad that you have refreshed my memory a bit. And so, of course, we also have Ethernet, which is like the only one I have ever used. But I think within data centers and so possibly within Google, you might also have other protocols on that layer, or am I wrong?
It's all possible. The most common by far is Ethernet, but there are other things that could be. You could have IP encapsulated in IP, so you have a lot of things that you can do there. NetStack 3 right now supports just two things. Either pure IP, where the driver tells me it's somehow capable of dealing with pure IP or IPv4, IPv6 frames, or an Ethernet frame. That's all we support right now.
Okay, very cool. And then let's also perhaps dive a bit into DHCP, because you also mentioned it at the start that you knew about it a bit, and then I guess it's very nice that you are now able to actually implement these protocols or at least further improve them. I know about DHCP. I do not know about DHCP v6, which I do think you also implement. So maybe let's start introducing DHCP, because not everybody will know about it, and then let's also go how DHCP v6 has improved it.
Okay, I'll use that to plug IPv6 and how awesome it is. So let's start with DHCP. DHCP is Dynamic Host Configuration Protocol, if memory serves me right. This is, like, you see this a lot in your, like, LAN at home, right? Typically, your router is going to run a DHCP server that's listening on a special UDP port, and when you turn on your laptop, your phone, it's going to broadcast a message asking, like, is there a DHCP server here? I want an IP address. And so DHCP is basically configuring IP address plus other things for your LAN. And so when the server is going to give you a liaison on an IP address that has a certain duration, DNS servers, like use these DNS servers to reach the internet, maybe like search domains, other things, this all typically over IPv4 is going to come from a DHCP message on the LAN. So it's called, like, DHCP is called a stateful thing there because the server side is keeping tabs on who it vended addresses to, right? And then so it both
Is that based on the MAC address? Like, how does it know that something incoming is the same?
It can be the MAC address, and the protocol also supports like a client identifier if needed. Yeah,
but is that something the client chooses, or what is that based at client identifier?
I think the RFC, I'm riffing now, but I think the RFC doesn't specify what must be a client identifier, but it's an optional thing. So it should fall back to the source MAC address when it's absent.
Okay. Thank you very much.
I think so. Yeah. So this is how typically you're going to get configured when you're bootstrapping yourself on a LAN with IPv4, right? IP is very, very different. So IPv6 relies on this other thing, and I love the latter soup of protocols I had to learn to implement in our stack, but it's called SLAC. So that's stateless address auto configuration, if you heard about it. But it's stateless because, like, think of it the play as the address space is so large, you can pretty much randomize your address and you're almost guaranteed to not get a conflict on your LAN because you have quite a bit of address space that is randomized, right? So typically on a LAN, you're going to randomize the last 64 bits of the address. And then you, on top of that, you're going to run DAD, which is duplicate address detection, to check before you assign the address, is anybody else have this address? And then you take it. And then with that, your router is doing, instead of the HTTP advertisements, which is not on a, you know, broadcasts, it's doing what is called router advertisements. So it's saying, hey, I'm a router. I can reach the internet. Here are some other parameters about this LAN, like the MTU you can use, prefixes, sorry, DNS servers, and then an address, a global address assignment prefix. That's the big thing, because on IPv6, you get a global address directly. You don't need NAT, which is network address translation. So IPv6 works very differently there. But in some situations, you want to have a stateful controlled address vending mechanism. And that's where DHCP v6 is in use. So it's somewhat similar to DHCP in what it does, but not really how it operates, a bit different. But you have a stateful server that you reach out to, and it can give you parameters just like DHCP v4 would. And it will give you addresses. It will give you prefixes. So if you're chaining routers, you can ask an upstream router, give me a prefix, a subset of your global prefix, so I can give to downstream things to me in my own array. So the HTTP/V6 is very powerful that way. And yeah, but a lot, I can say in my LAN, I don't have the HTTP/V6. Like IPv6 can work without it because of Slack.
Okay. And so there are two things I want to ask you about. The first is about, you were mentioning that you have the DAD, and it was like for deduplication of addresses, because the NIC on the LAN, it can choose a random IPv6, but it does need to check if it's not taken yet. How does it do that? Is that like some another unicast, and anybody who already had it can just respond to it, or how that works?
I love how deep we're getting. Yeah, so this... When you, I'll go as deep as I can, and just tell me to stop if it's too deep. But when you choose a tentative address, saying like I want to assign this address to myself, you join a multicast group that has a formation rule based on the address that you're trying to assign to yourself. It's called a solicited node multicast address. So you basically blast a multicast. And so this multicast is not a broadcast. Not everybody on the LAN is interested. Only somebody that has that address, or an address that is, like, by the formation rule ends up being the same, right, actually receives that, right? And so you send a probe out to this multicast group saying, hey, you know, does anyone have this address? And if they do, they're going to unicast reply back to you, right? And if they don't, then you're going to time out. And this is all like tunable, configurable, like how many tries you're going to do, right? And so typically you're going to now assign the address. And then I forget if the RFC specifies an advertisement period after that, just like to say, I got this. I don't remember. But yeah, that's kind of how it works. Like there's this well-formed multicast group, and everybody. So if you, once you've assigned the address, you continue listening on that address group, in case somebody asks. And the interesting thing for that and IPv6 is that the ARP equivalent for IPv6, which is NDP, Neighbor Discovery Protocol, uses roughly the same mechanism as DAD. So you keep listening on that address, and then a message could come in saying, like, either, you know, does anybody have this, or just like, do you have this? Because I want to resolve the MAC, the MAC address for Ethernet to send you some packets, right? And it uses the same packets, which is built on ICMPV.
Okay. Very cool. That's another bunch of letters to our soup.
Yeah.
Now, before I dive to ICMP, because I don't want to like touch too much topics at the same time, you mentioned, okay, there is DHCPv6, it's not really needed. What we didn't, however, highlight enough, I think, what are some good reasons when you do really want to use DHCPv6?
So, to my knowledge, what is basically network administration preferences. If you want to keep track of your clients, if you want to vend specific addresses to specific clients, right? That's what you would do. Typically, like, you know, in a home network, you don't have the necessity. You just want things to work, right? But on an enterprise setting, you might want to, so that you can keep tabs on all the clients. You know, maybe you have other protocols like MAC security that are going to clear before that or something. And the other big reason that I see this being used more is for prefix delegation. So we touched this on a little bit before. This is used with the Matter spec, if you're aware. The Matter spec is like this open specification for home IoT devices. They rely a lot on thread networks, so that's a different radio, and the radio runs on IPv6. And so you want your IoT network to get global IPv6 addresses if your IoT devices want to talk to the internet directly without network address translation. So if you have a DHCPv6 server on your LAN, you can ask it for a prefix. Hey, you know, I want to be a router for my low-pan network. So give me a prefix. It's part of the, let's think for a home network, you're going to get some 2 to 64 addresses allowance from your internet service provider, right? And you can allocate down, sometimes you get 2 to the 68, for example, right? So that gives you like a certain number of prefixes that you can vend down to downstream LANs and IPv6 routers. So that's a big use that I see that might be coming up with better getting bigger. But it really depends on, like, there are a lot of things that need to go right for this to go right. But I think that's, to my knowledge, the most common use of it that I could see.
Yeah, that's fair enough. And by the way, I also really like IPv6, especially because I used to do a lot of peer-to-peer networking and writing those protocols and building all those protocols. And it was always really annoying that you had to hold punch and pray that you could get through the network. And it was like you had to have like a multi-tier system where, like, if this fails, try this. If this fails, try this. And it was really very fallible. And yeah, IPv6 solves a lot of that. That said, we do a lot of consulting. And I feel that when I work with European customers, I have a lot less trouble with IPv6 than with American customers, where especially their firewalls are often, yeah, not really be able to route our traffic if we use IPv6. And it results in very, very hard to debug issues, which is why sometimes we just disable it completely, because it's, yeah, when it happens, it's very hard to find that was the cause. How is your experience with that within Google and, I don't know, in general?
That tracks. That tracks my experience. I cannot speak for like larger Google. I see like the IPv6 works seamlessly for me when, you know, I am mostly dealing with like an enterprise level network at a company the size of Google. You know, is that true on my home network? No. With my internet service provider, I have more than once. I don't know the reason. Like, I cannot even theorize why that would be, but I lose IPv6 connectivity and I still have IPv4. And I would never have known that if I was not in networking and know to go into my router and find that that was the problem and just turn off IPv6 on my devices for a bit until upstream IPv6 come back. It beats me why this is a problem, but it is.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, that's networking, I guess. And so we mentioned this, okay. Now, in order to help the world, with transitioning to IPv6, there's also the Happy Eyes protocol, and we also have now recently, well, not that recent, but I think there's a Happy Eyeball V2, and then I know like GER recently improved that. I know in my own network framework, which is called Rama, we also have an implementation of the first version still, I think, of Happy Eyeballs. Is that something you also implement within NetStack 3, and does it have a lot of benefit? Because even though I implemented it, I still sometimes question like how useful it really is, especially because then sometimes if it's enabled and there are IPv6, like IPv6 sometimes not allowed on a certain enterprise network or corporate network, and then you're kind of giving priorities to something that anyway will not really resolve to anything. How is it for, that's a lot at once, but in general, it's about Happy Eyeballs.
Yeah, no, I'm familiar. We've implemented Happy Eyeballs in Fuchsia as a library on top of POSIX, right? So NetStack 3 is not opinionated about that. It's we were giving you a POSIX socket. We're not solving any more problems than that. For now, we see that as like our system is componentized, and we see that as a higher layer problem, right? That's where we are on Happy Eyeballs. I actually don't have any sense of just how much that actually helps in practice for to raise the two connections, how many more wins you get. Yeah, that's I live below L4. That's an L5 plus problem.
I understand. Yeah, I have the opposite. I live above it. So yeah, that's very cool. Even though I do like to dive deeper sometimes below it, but that's usually just to inspect some traffic or learn about it. Now, that said, one of the reasons that Google, I think it was Google, pushed for like quick and then doing it on top of like UDP and doing it in user space was because, yeah, that then you have more control, etc. But I suppose, given that, I mean, imagine if the world was more built around microkernels, then TCP would also be more in user space. I imagine they might have not really done that move because you could just do a lot of improvements directly into the system. Or am I missing something there?
I think there might have been more motivations to quick than just that, but I heard that was a big one. And listen, it's hard to theorize what it would have been if the world was different for the past like 30 years or so, but I feel like just because a system is updatable, if we're being realistic, just because the system is updatable doesn't mean it gets updated sometimes. So it's an infrastructure problem, and infrastructure is hard to move, right? So my understanding is like the decision for quick to be over UDP is not really that it's like it was not available over TCP, is that doing a different L4 protocol was just too costly in terms of infrastructure. Right? Because you need, if every router is doing netting along the way, every router needs to understand your new protocol, and the install base is massive, right? I think that does play a part, right? But it, you know, I don't think the microkernel thing plays that much into it in terms of like being on top of UDP, right? If that makes sense. I'm sensing there was another point you're saying, is just like implementing it in user space or not. That's another part of it. And I really like that topic about quick being implemented in user space versus in kernel space or not, right? Because you could argue that the protocol can happen over UDP, but you could have a POSIX API for quick and implement it into the kernel. Right? You could.
It's possible.
It's possible. That gets more into like your not infrastructure side of updatability for new protocols. That gets more into your like, where do I want to implement this thing on my host? Right. And yeah, that's where just being more updatable. There have been no concrete conversations about this, but within the architecture of Fuchsia, there's a legitimate conversation that could be had, just like where, you know, should the application implement quick, or should NetStack 3 eventually offer a quick type socket? Right. There are many problems with this. Like there's the quick also has the security layer embedded in it. There are a lot of things to consider. But the reason that I really like that topic is that I've read already, I think, a Cloudflare and a Mozilla post about challenges with quick and syscall taxes, right? And that's fascinating because of POSIX. So if you have a TCP socket, right, the kernel is going to give you a streamed interface over POSIX, and you can read as many bytes as there are available and as many you give in to your RETV message call, right? Same for send message, right? As long as the kernel can just copy your user bytes into the TCP buffers, that's a single syscall for a lot of bytes, right? For UDP, you're typically going to be, if you're not using the advanced syscalls, if you're just using send and receive, for UDP, that's one datagram. So that's one syscall for roughly 1 kilobyte of data that you send and receive, right? And I see a lot of people that are moving to Quick in other applications, nowhere near Fuchsia, right, that are facing these troubles that are like if you're pushing enough traffic, you are doing, if in one TCP read, you were reading 100K, now it takes you, if you're just using regular receive calls, it's taking 100 syscalls to feed them that same amount of data from the network. And it's an interesting challenge that big protocols over UDP bring. And I just this week I read the blog post from Mozilla and how they changed the Firefox to use GRO. GRO is generic receive offload on Linux, and things like send M message to be able to just single syscall multiple messages and rec the M message as well. So yeah, it's a really cool topic because I care about the performance on that layer very deeply, right? That's what I'm really working on.
Yeah, for sure. And I have a feeling that eventually it will move to kernel space, even within the microkernel. I have a feeling for certain that NetStack 3 will eventually implement it, for the same reason that like TLS used to live outside the kernel, and it mostly still does, but now you also have like KTLS in Linux. It's not hard to imagine that also within, like, you already have Boring SSL at Google, so it's not that hard to imagine that you will maybe using Boring SSL or maybe the successor to it, I'm not sure if there is one, that you might just, or maybe you will adopt Russell's, possible, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, there is definitely a good reason why, because that would mean that your application doesn't need to, again, choose this, doesn't need to implement it. Like, it's a lot easier for developers, and as you said, there is so much freedom you can do as a developer of the microkernel and the modules around it to really deal with the performance and make it very nice to use.
Yeah, the performance thing is what excites me about doing something like this in a Fuchsia type architecture, is because in terms of developer ergonomics, if I give you a good library that is implementing Quick with all the good things, that like your ergonomics are mostly there, right? But now there is the interface between your library and the system, right? And being as composable as Fuchsia is, we can make some interesting choices, right? About, I'll give you an IPC API that gives you Quick streams, right? That is doable within the architecture for sure. And I think it's an exciting thing to consider. And that for a lot of things.
Yeah, for sure. And then if we wind a bit back to TCP, which is pretty much where my story usually ends, is I noticed that depending on the like Linux variant or POSIX variant or whatever, like for example, if it's Dragon or if it's like FreeBSD or whatever, they all come with their unique set of options only available to them. And I know also in Android there are a couple of them. What are some of the custom options you have, for example, in Fuchsia? And why was there a good enough reason to then add that to it? Because in a way, you kind of like break POSIX then. I mean, not really break, because it's like extra, but still. Like, I suppose it must be a very good reason to have such an extra option.
I think we're mostly following like Linux-flavored POSIX for most things. The one addition that we have that it's in the code base, but I actually don't think it's exported in libc, is we have, like, this is very deep, but we have in Linux, you have the context of marking a socket, and that you can match that on firewall rules. And in Fuchsia, we have more than one mark. So, like, that's a Fuchsia flavor thing. If you want to match sockets to firewall rules or even routing rules, you can, Linux has this thing called FW mark, I think it's what it's called, and it's the socket option is SO underscore mark. In Fuchsia, that works differently. We have more than one mark. Those are the just 32-bit scalars that get matched in matching rules. And I don't think we explore that in libc at all today. So, you know, if you're just using POSIX, you wouldn't be able to see that. So we haven't needed to, but in fairness, we have decades less than a lot of these other systems to have built these things, so the need hasn't come. Right.
I understand. So, crystal comb, I suppose. Now, yeah, that's that. But then my next question is, often when you're dealing with operating systems, you are also dealing with unsafe code, because in the end you have to go down to system calls, etc. But given that Fuchsia is fully in Rust, does that mean that you barely have any unsafe code, or do you still have some, and why is that then?
No, just to nitpick, Fuchsia is not fully in Rust. NetStack 3 is fully in Rust. Fuchsia, you could call it, you know, 95% Rust and C++. I don't know between those two languages what the split is. So for NetStack 3, it's fully in Rust. And NetStack 3 is organized as follows. We have what we call a core crate that doesn't care what system we're running on. It has no Fuchsia concepts inside it. Okay, and that's where all the protocols are implemented. That's where most of the POSIX API things look like they're implemented. But it doesn't know, right? It basically has hooks for everything that is outside of the, you know, the core protocol machinery, right? And then we have Fuchsia bindings around it. Tor, which is all of our, the protocol core is, we managed to do without almost any unsafe. It's been a bit since I did an audit, but I think we had something around maybe an init slices. That was the only like really memory and safety thing there. And we do rely super heavily on types as statements for checks that have happened on a data structure, right? So I have a type that is like, oh, this is a unicast IP address. I have checked it, right? So it's a unicast IP. It's like unicast IP address is the name of the type, and you can only construct that type if you've run the checks in the unicast, right? So we have a couple of unsafe versions of that. If you want to skip the checking, just construct none of that. So it's not really memory unsafety. And if you just grab for unsafe, you're going to find that we use that a lot in test code to declare costs. Right now, for Fuchsia bindings, where things get real, because you're tying now to the shared memory of the driver, we do have some use of unsafe there, right? Because you have some area of map memory, and it's just one giant chunk of memory, and the protocol with the driver tells you how to slice it. You have an unsafe pointer there at the end, and then we just put a safe API around it that basically gives you something that looks like a slice out of it, and what else? And in the lower layer, we have, I think it's still around maybe, we have manually dropped for all of our resources, everything that is a dynamic resource, so interfaces, sockets, all of that. We use this special data structure that we always make strong statements. It's kind of an arc that dropping the last one is special. I wanna know that dropping the last one actually happened to make sure the system cleanup happened. So that is an auxiliary crate to core, we implemented that, and that has a little bit of unsafe. You could replace this with Arc, but like we really cared about knowing when the last thing went out, and so we have this thing that wraps an Arc. Like buffer, copying, all of that, we really try to not use unsafe. That was the goal in the beginning of NetStack 3. There's always the temptation, right? Oh, if I just unsafe this, it would be so much easier to get it done. But like you pay the cost later, right? So you don't want to. You want to really do it. So NetStack 3 is heavily built in terms of parquet, you know, in terms of byte manipulation. We build heavily on zero copy, which is a project that was born out of Fuchsia, and it's like out there in the Rust community, has so many downloads. So zero copy is the base. Then we have our packet parsing serialization crates. And then they all build on zero copy. So like that gives me a lot of guarantee that I'm doing zero copy parsing of data as much as I can with the zero copy guarantees there. And yeah, we call it packet formats crate, I think, where we do all of our parsing and serialization, right? So that, in terms of byte manipulation, we rely on that, and that solves a lot of like the things that would be shady or that you might want to use in Safe4 or something.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes sense totally. And it more or less falls in the expectation of what I would think you would still use in Safe4. I also know about Zero Copy. I like the creator a lot, but perhaps not all of our audience knows about Zero Copy. So could you just give like a quick summary of what Zero Copy does and why you would want to use it?
All right. So Zero Copy gives you edit score, safe traits and derives to do safe transmute, basically. Think of it like a really safe transmute. It gives you guarantees that you're interpreting this slice of bytes as a struct or as, you know, a scalar of any kind, right? And like that's incredibly useful for networking, because that's what we're doing. We're parsing things as struct. We want to avoid all the UBs that happen if you're reading unaligned, if you're reading, or if you're just reading out of a life, you're reading on panic or whatever. So we heavily use it. All of the parsing serialization grades rely on Zero Copy to do safe parsing serialization, but without the cost of copying it out of the buffer.
Very nice. That's indeed a good way to describe it. Thank you for that. And then in Rust, you also have asynchronous programming, like in many modern languages. Is it used in NetStack 3? And if so, which kind of runtime do you use?
Okay, that's a great question. I talked before about the layers NetStack 3 is built around. Core does not have async. Okay, so like the Fuchsia bindings do use async, and we have our own runtime. It's called Fuchsia _async. And it's built heavily on Zircon, on the Zircon port primitive. So think of it as, you know, it's exactly like the ports. I think Mac OS X has ports as well that look a lot like this. But yeah, it's called Fuchsia async. It's our runtime. It works really good for Fuchsia because of the port mechanism, because a lot of components in Fuchsia are really just sitting to make IPC calls, and the IPC call shows up on the port. It is way leaner than Tokyo. Not in the good way, in the bad way, in which like Tokyo has a lot of really cool features. The Tokyo work scheduler is absolutely awesome. And ours is a little bit more naive still. There's work to do there, if you ask me. So that's how we do it. Because the Tokyo, we can't run Tokyo on Fuchsia today, is my understanding, as like the Tokyo runtime.
Okay, that's fair enough. And are there any things that you like about the Fuchsia async runtime that you think Tokyo on its turn could benefit from, of like maybe adopting of learning lessons from?
Oof. The problem is I work so little with Tokyo. I would be surprised if we have something that they don't. We did a big push for scopes in Fuchsia async, right? So whenever you are spawning a new task, you can have a hierarchy of scopes, and then you can cancel the hierarchy of scopes, and just like that kills all the tasks. Like it's a structured asynchronous. I heard that Tokyo was introducing something like that. I never followed up. That's been working well for us to keep track of all the async tests that you do, and we integrate that with our debugger, which is like ZXDB. So I can do, like, I can interactively just print all the tests that are currently, like, queued or whatever, and there's, you know, by pausing the program. That's super useful, like, if you've ever had a gigantic program with so many async tasks running, regardless of how many threads your executor has, that's objectively useful.
Yeah, for sure. But then I cannot stop to wonder, like, I know Alice, who is currently the head maintainer of Tokyo, took over kind of like the duties of Carl, like she works at Google. Is he then also maybe in contact with the Fuchsia async runtime team, or are you not aware of it at all? I mean, did you ever talk to Alice about this kind of stuff, or is it like a completely different department?
The company is too big. The company is just too big for me to know everyone. Maybe I have interacted and just don't remember, to be honest with you. But there's a growing Rust community within the company, and it's even hard to keep track of everything that happens together.
Yeah, I believe, if I recall correctly, she works on the Android team, but I might be wrong.
Yeah, I don't know.
So, yeah, fair enough. Okay. And then something which I wonder is like, okay, it's one thing to have async, and also it makes completely sense that your core crate is just pure code without async, because you don't really need it there, because it's more about protocols, about how do you encode it, how you decode it. That makes totally a lot of sense. But then within the actual async code, do you make use a lot of the new features, or do you still write more like your own futures, etc., or how that works there?
I try so much to not write our own futures, so much. So if you can just use the sugar and rely on the compiler to do the right thing for you, that's kind of what we do. We have utilities crates. So futures are monorepo, right? We have async utilities crates around the repository for things that are very common, for dealing with like fuchsia flavored IPC, for example, that justify hand rolling a future for some things. And then I think we do hand roll for things that are very important for the data path being fast, for example, right? So like I need to notify, like wake up a task so that it sends more data to the driver, for example, right? I believe that notifier is a hand rolled future today.
Okay, very cool. Then besides this, there is also, okay, so you have your own TCP stack and your own coder on that. And I want to talk in a bit about how you see the future of Nestec Tree. And I know you have like a book tracker of like wider adoption outside of Fuchsia. So I want to go into there. But I'm aware of one crate, which is small TCP, which is already used in several different projects, including, which I think is Redux, but I'm not sure, but it's definitely used in a couple of such projects. What do you know about that project, and how does it compare a bit? I mean, I know you are like a native Fuchsia, you're native NetStack, so I'm not like expecting you to do like here like a full analysis, but still you're an expert in your field, and I'm sure your opinion is well respected.
Yeah, I've browsed the code. I've never done anything serious with small TCP. If I had infinite time, I would spend all of my extra time writing embedded code, and I would use it because I miss writing embedded code. So I think that's one of the big differences, right? Small TCP, first of all, they seem to be targeting way smaller systems than we are, right? And they do it in a really nice way. So like they're very careful about memory allocations, and probably like the general code footprint of the program, right? And so they seem less bound by the POSIX requirements than us, but I, you know, maybe reasonable minds could differ there because everybody has the same kind of expectations sometimes about these things. So it looks pretty complete and very easy to use from my perspective for an embedded system, but we diverge in the sense that if I was comparing it with NestEC 3, we really want to be like a general purpose OS thing. So, you know, I have multiple user threads opening multiple different sockets. I need, you know, my demux to be fast. I need netting. I need a stateful firewall. All of the ladder two protocols that we talked about, to my knowledge, small TCP implements them all. Maybe not the HTTP/6. I don't remember. So it's a very complete stack, right? But in terms of how you build the architecture, I think we differ quite a bit in the sense that like we're targeting, I don't want to say bigger systems, but I'm liking the word. You know, it's more like general purpose, more like almost more desktop-y, if that's the thing, right? And that changes how you write the code, right? We're a user space stack, so I have a heap, I have an allocator. I would like to be able to, when allocator API stabilizes, to actually be explicit about the allocators everywhere, right? In NestEC 3, we don't do that today. I have some VEX around that I just push onto, and it works, right? I think that would be like the big difference for me there that I see. And one thing that I learned at great pains when building a network stack is that most of your problems, the bugs and the, you know, the delicate bits come from when your system changes, right? Interface goes online, offline, interface gets removed, interface gets added, right? And so like I find that likely not that common in embedded systems or systems that small TCP is trying to target, right? And maybe that's solvable as the user of the small TCP API. We took a stance that we want Core to be a little bit more opinionated about just like, you know, I want to make sure that like, if you want to remove the interface, I'm going to, you know, either allow a packet that is referenced to the interface to make it fully through the stack, right? So we use Arc, we abstract locking mutexes to a different crate, but we're using stud mutexes or like a Fuchsia specific mutex implementation, right? So if you stare at the code, it's very, very different, but I think because we're trying to solve a different problem.
Yeah, for sure. That makes sense. And so I wonder, let's say you have a very special purpose and you need, like, despite the fact that you have to deploy on Linux, but you do need to have control over the TCP stack. Is there a way, even though you're on Linux, to use something like small TCP or maybe in the future like Fuchsia and do your own TCP so that you can have more control? Or is that something that is just not possible as a user from user space?
Boy, I never thought about that question. Like, I don't want to write code on the fly with you, but there must be a way. The question is like, how do you do that in a way that is performant, right? And that you also take out the Linux TCP stack thing, right? So yes. If you wanted to do that, if you wanted me to do that today with you, I would use Linux SunTap networking to do this. So you create a user space interface, and then you're going to get raw bytes. You're going to get raw Ethernet bytes with the tap interface. And then so you just throw that into small TCP or NetStack 3, right? And let it do the full processing, right, of the frames, not only you know, not trying to extract the TCP bits, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, totally. That's indeed what I had in mind, but it's cool that you had a similar vision. I mean, of course, it's something very niche, but I just sometimes just wonder a bit about it. And so, as we are nearing the end, I do want to talk a bit about the future. I mean, I know we don't have a magic orb, and telling the future is always a bit difficult, but given there is an issue tracker about it, and given there are sometimes questions about, okay, can we use NetStack 3 outside, just for the same reason that NetStack 1, at least I'm aware of, maybe NetStack 2, also had like a lot of different use cases, even outside Google. Like, what do you see the roadmap to be there, or is it still very undefined?
We know the problems were, right? So we got some interest in our issue tracker to get NetStack 3 in crates.io so people could use it. What is in the way? The obvious things are Fuchsia uses the GN build system, a little bit of Bazel. And so I want to do this in a way that I have like a good cargo TOML build system that people can use in crates.io, and that hopefully we can just tie it up that it gets updated in a way that is maintainable for us, right? You know, that it doesn't become like a major chore to keep this. That's number one. Number two is over the years, we've tried to make sure the core crate is no stud, but it has like, you know, dependencies. And so if people, and specifically talking about like something like Redox, that would be work to do there maybe to make sure that this can compile on like what effectively they're doing in kernel space, right? That will be work there. So like weeding out dependencies that made it into the crates, you know, by mistake or just, you know, as intentional tech that we knew we would have to remove, those would have to get all weeded out. And then basically figure out, like, you have to figure out this pipeline. You have to figure out all the dependencies because NetStack 3 is not a single crate, right? We build on zero copy. We have the packet parsing and serialization framework crate, and then packet formats, which uses the framework to just define all the network packets that we use for all the protocols. And then NetStack 3 core itself is like one crate per layer, roughly, right? So we have a device IP, and then for the socket CCP UDP crates. So all of that would have to make up and be figure out some sort of stability API, right? Because it's just something that people do. And then back to your original question, this is a massive code base. So I think it's a very tall ask to ask of anybody to use this without a sample program. So we would have to do something like what you suggested, just like, what is the toy program that I could write that runs on Linux, for example, that shows NetStack 3 working, right, as a starting point for somebody that wants to integrate it into whatever system they want, right? Those are the immediate things that I see that we would want to do so that this is usable, right? Because it is open source, right? So like going back to what we were talking about before, familiarity is what matters here, right? I want to make sure that this feels like a Rust open ecosystem crate, right? There's work there because it has lived for all its life in the Fusion Mono repo.
Yeah, for sure. Now, I do wonder, is there anything, I mean, I suppose it is, but what is technically stopping you, for example, from using Cargo natively and using that as a core in the Bazel setup that you have, or in the, you call it GM, but I guess related to Bazel, but in a way that you just, so you still have all your Bazel workflows and your, and all those things, but for just building and compiling the Rust crates, it would like piggyback on your Cargo workflow. Is that possible, or will it always be something separate?
I don't know. I haven't spent enough time looking at it. What I can tell you is that the NetStack itself is not yet migrated to Bazel. We're still using GM, which makes this way harder.
Okay.
So that, I think that's point number one, right? And we have to still sit down and explore what the option space here is, right? So that we do it. Like, listen, we just got the interest. It's always been in our hearts to consider this, right? And we're developing this in the open, right? There's a usability barrier here that we need to cross, but there are some technical challenges with it, for sure.
Yeah. And then, besides being a good citizen and contributing back to the world, like, is there, like, a true incentive to do this? Because it seems like a massive work, and I suppose it's not, like, an easy sell to the higher-ups to undertake such a massive project of, like, preparing it to bring it to the open.
I don't think it's a hard sell, honestly. If one of these operating systems is really interested, it's the sort of thing where we would probably eventually get contributions back, or at least learnings, right? So if you're just thinking coldly about that, not the fact that you're contributing with the world, I believe that has its own benefits, right? Because, like, why do people have plug fests, right? People have plug fests because connectivity is hard, and sometimes you have to put these two peers together so that they break together or something. So in my view, anything that is related to connectivity, the more people using it, you're going to derive some benefit, right? Maybe somebody picks this up and tries to use it on a school project to, like, a satellite network, and then discovers that, you know, like, this insane latency that I work with actually breaks NetStack. That's fun, right? But that hasn't happened. I'm just riffing on a friend of mine's school project. He'd actually did that and found the network stack at the time. I don't even know. This was back in Brazil. That completely buckled under, like, satellite levels of latency, right? So, like, this has stuck with me when I just resurfaced in my head when I started working with networking. It's just like, there's so many crazy uses for this. And I am not working on this, but people may. And if it makes my stack more robust, then yeah, I think there's an incentive there. I cannot speak for the higher ups, but yeah, it feels like there's an incentive there.
Yeah, for sure. That's very interesting. And so we are coming a bit near the ending. We talked about a lot already. I do want to give you a chance, like, is there, for example, like, a certain kind of protocol that you really like, or a kind of detail, or something there that you really want to share because, like, you're very passionate about it, or you thought that's really, like, interesting, unexpected, whatever?
Yeah, I think we touched on my favorite thing, which is I love Slack, the stateless address auto configuration. It's so great. It's so great. I love it. Just like read the RFC if you have the opportunity. It's a gem. Maybe some people see problems with it that I don't see. Of course, nothing is perfect, but it's really, really, really cool. For plug and play type things, right? So like it just works. It's less setup. Yeah, IPv6, is going to eventually take over the world. It's taking over the world. It's great. Always a big plug for it. And yeah, I'm always going to plug Fuchsia. This is the most fun thing I've done in my career by a mile. And so if you like systems programming or just like low-level operating system things, Fuchsia.dev has a lot of fun reads just for, you know, learn a thing or two.
Okay. And how is the hiring? Like, let's say someone really wants to work with you or your peers on Fuchsia or NetStack Tree. Is that something you also like open to, or is it like for now you have sufficient amount of people and you just want to wait a bit with it?
Yeah, the canned answer is jobs.google.com or Google Careers. Just go there, apply. Yeah.
Okay. That's very good advice. So with that in mind, I want to thank you for your time. It was an amazing conversation. I learned a lot. I feel we could talk for hours about protocols. And honestly, I hope one day we can share a drink and do so. I will gladly take up you on that opportunity. Take care and enjoy the rest of your life.
Thank you for having me, Glenn. It was awesome.
NetStack.fm is brought to you by Plavio, building secure, open, and resilient infrastructure with trust, protocols, and purpose. This show is also made possible by Rama, the open source networking framework. Plavio offers service contracts and welcome sponsorships to keep building and supporting its ecosystem. The theme music of this podcast was composed by DJ Mailbox. If you enjoyed this episode, don't forget to subscribe on your favorite podcast platform and leave a 5-star review. It really helps others discover the show. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you next time for the next handshake.